Welcome to the Buckmaster Show for Monday, January 24th. We begin with our fourth week of the Buckmaster Show and hope you had a great weekend. I am Bill Buckmaster, your host for the Buckmaster Show on KJLL AM 1330 and always on the World Wide Web at buckmastershow.com. We are, of course, live streaming on thejolt.com as well. We're live weekdays from 9 to 10 a.m. The program re-airs from 7 to 8 p.m. here on KJLL. On today's show, we're going to lead off with a newsmaker interview with Sean McCluskey, candidate for mayor of the city of Tucson. We'll talk climate change with Zach Guido of the UA Climate Project, and Dr. David Steffen will be here exploring the question, does the past have a future? The Buckmaster Show is primarily an interview-driven show, but there's always room for listener comments and questions. You can call us on our Buckmaster Show hotline, 529-3508, 529-3508. And 2011 is an election year in the city of Tucson. Among the positions at stake, the mayor. And we'll be talking with all the candidates here on the Buckmaster Show before the election finally gets underway. But today we meet former city council candidate Sean McCluskey. He's a 38-year-old businessman originally from the Chicago area who made an unsuccessful bid for the council in 2009. He is the first candidate to formally file a statement of organization in what could be a crowded race for mayor. Mr. McCluskey joins us now. He's been very active in Republican circles. Sean, good to see you.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about your campaign. Why did you decide to run for mayor?
Well, after the unsuccessful bid that you talked about in 2009 for Ward 5, nothing has changed. Steve Kay has made a lot of headway, but we have a rubber stamp for a mayor. You know, back in the day of Lou Murphy would get riled up from the all-Democratic council that he'd had, and he'd walk out to Bill, he'd walk up to Bud Foster and say, hey, Bud, can I grab 30 seconds of airtime? And Bud would listen to him, and he would put him out, and he would actually, you know, have him come out on and go on air, and he would blast the city council instead of just rubber stamping everything that goes through. We need a dynamic voice, we need a strong voice, and we need somebody who can lead Tucson through the future.
What is wrong with this community, and what's right with it?
Well, you know, we do a lot of things right. Public safety and public security here in Tucson. We have some of the best police officers, some of the some of the best firefighters in town as well. What we don't do right is we don't do transparency financially. We don't have fiscal responsibility. We chase businesses away. We need to encourage businesses to come to Tucson. And at the end of the day, you know, we really, really, I think, need to have fiscal responsibility and transparency. Our city budget, if you take a look at it, which they're discussing now here this Wednesday, it's an absolute joke. The only way that they can come about with an answer is to raise taxes. Now, we just went through an election, and 63% of Tucson agreed with me that we don't need any more taxes. They were trying for a half-cent sales tax. Now they're coming out with four more taxes. It's a blatant attack on the local small business. 85% of our community is hired or works for small businesses. I mean, those are the numbers that come out of city council. Karen Ulick has said that several times. But yet, they have a city manager who insists on always going after the business community without coming up with creative solutions. They just want a tax. Why can't we look at different solutions? Why can't we go advertise somewhere else? Why can't we look at some of the things that we have and utilize them and go to some of the other cities that aren't doing so well? And they're coming up with creative solutions that are raising revenue without raising taxes. But yet we have a one-track trolley, if you will, and our broken record of a city manager and a mayor keep continuing to sing the same song and dance.
You brought up the trolley. What's wrong with the trolley?
$43 million a mile.
That's what's wrong with it.
It goes 4 miles. They're saying that it's supposed to create this big economic boom, and we have a land use code that won't allow that.
Won't we have economic development all along the trolley as being touted that this is going to be an economic driver?
They're saying that it's going to be, but, you know, I mean, so is the hotel. And if you want to talk about two boondoggles that are going to be hung around the mayor's neck, it's the trolley and the hotel. Neither one of them are financial responsible. They're not fiscally responsible at all. The hotel is burdened on taxpayers' backs, and the trolley is coming through, once again, taxpayers' backs through a government subsidy. It's $43.3 million a mile. How many buses could we buy? You know, what alternatives could we use? They call it the modern streetcar. I'm sorry, this technology was developed in, like, what, 1940? if we're going to use modern technology, let's come up with something that's a little more diverse and a little more useful than a set track of 4.3 miles.
We're talking with Sean McCluskey, candidate for mayor. If you have a question for Mr. McCluskey, 529-3508. Let's talk about solutions. You said there are other cities that are finding creative solutions. What are some that you see that we could do here, perhaps with not a lot of money at stake?
Well, let's look at where we're from, Chicago. You have Rahm Emanuel, who is running for mayor there, and he took the city manager's idea of Chicago and stole it, basically, and came out and said, you know, we have all these vehicles and we have all these avenues that we can use to gain advertising dollars. And, okay, it's an effective solution. So we can bring that and we can look at it here. There are other ways that we can partner with local companies and give them advertising rights for certain areas if we get something in exchange that takes a burden off the taxpayers. Working with a local company now that is actually one of our major electric providers, and they are looking at a solution for Reed Park. Drive by Reed Park tonight about 8 o'clock.
What will I see?
Every light in the tennis court. You could hold a book club in the middle of the tennis courts, and there's probably two or three people playing tennis, but all the lights are on. It's a wasteful endeavor by the city, but yet we have no creative solution to get away from that. Now, we could run those lights 24/7 if the power was free. So let's start looking at a solution there.
Residency, front page of the Arizona Daily Star today, that department heads and higher, at least the higher ups in the city, need to live in the city. Do you think that's a good idea or no? Or is that,
well, I mean,
is that
the headline should have said, the city of Tucson is so bad, your upper management doesn't want to live here. That's what it comes down to. I mean, 2/3 of our police officers and 2/3 of our firefighters don't live in the city. All of our upper management lives outside of the city. Well, not all of it. That's a bold statement. But a good portion of it lives outside of the city because they don't want to live here. I mean, travel north on La Cholla. You know there's a demarcation in the road. When you leave Tucson, you quit rattling your teeth, and all of a sudden you go into Moreno Oro Valley, whichever it converts right there, and the roads get silky smooth. Why don't we have that here in Tucson? Why does Marana have such a high concentration of our police officers living up there?
Because we don't have the money to fix the roads. That's what we're told.
Yeah, well, no, we don't use the money we have wisely. There are choices that are being made by our city council and our city manager that are for the benefit of the city council members, not for the citizens. When you start taking into account that your job is to work for the citizens of Tucson and not for yourself, we'll have a better place. We have council members right now that are self-serving and do not serve the community. Most of them do it for a paycheck. I'm not in it for a paycheck. I'm in it because I want a Tucson that I'm proud of and that I want to live in. I want businesses to come here. I want people to come here. We are based on sales tax revenue, and we can invite businesses to come here, and we can create connectivity through those businesses. If we bring in a biomedical firm, there's widgets or whatever the biomedical firm makes, we want to bring the continuing company or the counter company to come in and make those here in Tucson as well.
We're talking with Sean McCluskey. Mr. McCluskey, a candidate Republican running for the city mayor's job here in Tucson. There's also talk again about a renter's tax.
For the third year in a row, you're going to come out with a renter's tax. You're going to hit the people the hardest that are the working class individuals. You know, every one of our council members on the Democratic side come out and say, we're for the working poor. Really? You're for the working poor, but you're going to hit them the hardest. You're going to hit the people that are renting. And right now, I'm in real estate. I mean, I run a property management firm and I run a real estate firm. I can tell you over the last 3 years, thousands of people in Tucson have lost their homes. When they lose their homes, where are they going to go? They're looking for opportunities. They're looking for opportunities to reestablish their household and continue to move on and thrive in Tucson. By putting this renter tax on, you're going to chase people out of Tucson. Not only landlords, they're going to go to the county, and they're not going to have the opportunity. You're going to create foreclosures because you can't rent your house because you've outpriced yourself. This is going to have an extreme adverse effect on the citizens who are living in your community that are not renters. The regular everyday homeowner, you're going to devalue their property by causing foreclosures. This is a horrible idea.
How about downtown? Is it coming back?
You know, you have a few, let's call them slightly crazy individuals who are opening businesses downtown. And, you know, when you talk to them, they'll tell you, look, we're a little nuts because we just went through 15 months to get through to open. 15 months to start a business.
But don't they believe in downtown?
That's why they tell you they're slightly crazy, because they believe in downtown, but they went through all the pain and suffering to wade through the land use code, to wade through the permit process, to wade through plans and development. we're not encouraging businesses to grow in Tucson in any way, shape, or form. We do everything we can to fight them every step of the way. And it's really odd because all of our general fund comes from where? Sales tax revenue. But you don't encourage businesses to open in Tucson. You fight them every step of the way. And then you wonder at the end of the day, we're down $70 million this year because our sales tax revenue. And they'll blame it on state shared revenues, which is absolutely wrong. Because if you were to take the state shared revenues, the state should have reduced our share by 25% over the last 2 years, and they've only reduced it 8%. So the state's giving us more than they should in these hard economic times. If it was fair, they would say, okay, well, the state's down 25%. You as a city should be down 25%. So they brought it down 8% or whatever the number was. So with that being said, you know, we need to look at ways to increase our general fund and our sales tax revenue. Get out of the way of the businesses. Help them instead of hindering them.
If you were to be elected mayor, would you go through every department and closely look at whether or not perhaps they are a little fat in some of these departments?
Absolutely. We would have a comprehensive look, and we would take a look, and we'd start with zero-based budgeting. We'd look at ways that you can increase technology, look at ways that you can streamline your process. If you have an individual who's not pulling his weight and doing his job, it's time to replace him. You know, I'm sorry, but we need to run the city like a business. And we need to have it run in an effective fashion, and it needs to work. If we have too many employees, it's time to streamline and cut and figure out where we can remove some. Now, I said it during Prop 400, and I'll say it again. We have too many managers up top, and we have not enough worker bees on the bottom. If you get rid of some of your department heads and you consolidate departments, you keep the worker bees, the people actually physically do the work, and you get rid of the fat up top.
You kind of led the charge, didn't you?
I was the committee chairman for Prop 400, and we had 63% of Tucson tell the city and the city manager, no more taxes.
Police and fire, how would you assess where we are right now?
Number one priority, and it's our number one priority, or it should be the citizens' number one priority, and the city council and mayor's and city manager's number one priority. Unfortunately, it's not. The city council and city manager came out with a number during Prop 400 because I threatened them with a recall and said, if you cut one police officer, one firefighter, I pulled the recall paperwork and brought it down to City Hall and said, I will recall you. It's not a threat. It's a promise. They played games. And they started, oh, well, we're just going to wait until we have through attrition or through people quitting or through layoffs, or not through layoffs, through retirements, we're going to get to the magic number of 180. Now, at the time, we were down 150 officers. We're down now 182 officers. They needed to lose 30 more officers at the end of Prop 400. And all of a sudden, there were 110 officers looking to go elsewhere. There's no contingency plan. And we've paid for these officers to be trained. And to spin up a brand new officer, it's roughly about $100,000 with equipment and the academy and everything else. And then it's a two-year period before they can get released on the street by themselves. Well, their magic number was 180. We're at 182 right now. So we're down two officers with no academy in the future and no money to pay for the academy. So you're jeopardizing the safety of your community, which you live in and you represent as a city council member, as the mayor, and as a city manager. You're not doing your job. If you can't protect this community, please step down, get out of the way, quit. Let somebody in there who can. If it's still about the paycheck at the end of the day, you're not serving your community. And I don't feel there's a city council member except for Steve Kay, especially the mayor, the city manager as well. None of them are protecting this community.
How do we get those positions filled without any money?
That's a great question. We're going to have
What would you suggest? What kind of ideas?
Well, we're going to look at different ways to raise the funds. However, there's going to need to be cuts if they're unwilling to look at comprehensive ways to create revenue into the city without making taxes, then there's going to have to be cuts in certain areas. But would you rather have bus service at $35 million, or would you have a police officer respond, or a firefighter, or a paramedic respond when you're in time of need? Look at I pick on RTA and I pick on SunTran extensively, but I cannot tell you how many times I see empty buses rolling through this town. Now, since I'm in property management, I'm all over the city every single day. And every single day you see 10, 20, 30 buses that are completely empty or with one or two people in them. That's just not an effective way to run the system. We give SunTran $35 million a year. $35 million a year. 90% of it is serviced in Tucson, but there are other areas that service it, and we're not getting our bang for our buck. Why do we hire a management company out of Cleveland, Ohio to tell us what our routes are in Tucson? We can't come up with a local company? I mean, Gray Line Tours has been doing it for 100 years. They should be able to effectively operate SunTran just like they've ran Gray Line for 100 years.
Well, I got a minute to go with Sean McCluskey, Republican candidate for mayor. A lot of people are concerned that live around the Elkhorn area. What do you say to the people who are worried about Walmart moving into Elkhorn?
Well, Walmart's going to bring sales tax revenue to the city of Tucson to the tune between $2 and $3 million, and that's operating in its normal scope of hours. I know that the city council wants to restrict the hours of operation. I know the community and the surrounding area is upset about it. Well, we can do one of two things. I mean, there's a smarty pants comment, if you will. Look, if you don't want Walmart to come, that's great. The surrounding 1.5 mile around the Elkhorn Center, we're just going to raise your property tax to compensate for it and then make sure it all goes to the city. If we did something like that, maybe we'd get them to play ball a little better. But it is a vital part of our sustainability. We need stores to come in. We need businesses to come in. Why are we chasing them away?
Sean McCluskey, thank you for visiting with us on the Buckmaster Show. Good luck in your race for mayor.
Appreciate it, sir.
Thanks a lot. We have State Representative Matt Hines. Dr. Hines will be on the Buckmaster Show live line next. Don't go away.
Sarnoff Artist Materials is Tucson's award-winning destination for everything art-related, including fine and graphic artist supplies, framing, stationery, and the world's best writing instruments. Visit owner-operator, artist Henry Sarnoff at 2504 North Campbell, 3 blocks north of Grant, and always at the easy-to-navigate website, sarnoffart.com. Because it takes an artist to know an artist's needs.
Vero Amore presents Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan pizza using fresh homemade mozzarella and the finest quality toppings. Taste pizza as it was meant to be at Vero Amore, casual yet upscale dining with an extensive boutique wine list. Vero Amore in Tucson at North Swan and Cap Lowell, Dove Mountain in Marana, and on the web at veroamorepizza.com. Coming soon, Noble Hops, Tucson's first gastro pub.
Hi, I'm Mark Sublett, owner of Medicine Man Gallery, and I'd like to invite you to come visit me. Medicine Man Gallery is located at 7000 East Tinka Verde, at the southwest corner of Tinka Verde and Sabino Canyon, and online at medicinemangallery.com. With 12,000 square feet of exhibit space, we have a wide array of American paintings, antique Indian art, and contemporary modern art by some of the masters of the West, including Ed Mell, John Moyers, and Maynard Dixon. If you have old Indian art or American paintings you'd like to sell or consign, call me for a free evaluation, as we're always looking to add to our collection. If you can't visit us on Tinka Verde, then visit us online. We have over 6,000 objects to view at medicinemangallery.com. So come visit me, Mark Sublett, at Medicine Man Gallery on the corner of Tinka Verde and Sabino Canyon, where there's always something new to see.
Four minutes past the hour on the Buckmaster Show. It's buckmastershow.com, and we are live 9 to 10 right here on KJLL, Monday through Friday. Well, citing the shootings in Tucson, a Southern Arizona lawmaker wants to force public schools, community colleges, and universities to report students whose behavior might make them dangerous if they ever got a gun. The legislation is sponsored by Dr. Matt Hines. Dr. Hines is state representative from Tucson, a Democrat, and he's on the Buckmaster Show live line right now. Dr. Hines, good to talk with you.
Great to be here, Bill. How are you?
Doing very well. Tell us about this legislation you're introducing.
Certainly. And the concept, I think, is pretty simple. Looking at the recent tragic events, I think one of the components that could have possibly allowed for this to be prevented would be a better integration of some information that several entities actually already had about this individual. And the basic concept of this bill is to, instead of allow, because currently institutions like those you described in this that would be affected may report these types of behavior to law enforcement, but don't have to, and simply requiring that mandatory reporting, almost similar in a way to, for example, if I, as a medical provider, or if a teacher in a classroom detects some suspicious findings that could indicate abuse or neglect, there's a duty to report. I'm looking at it very similarly, that instead of allowing these institutions to do so, requiring institutions to make a report, to refer these individuals to the county attorney, county sheriff, and possibly even the local behavioral health crisis center to make sure that these folks get the help they need, and that in the most egregious cases, like the one of this in particular individual, these could possibly be screened out of the population and taken care of before any tragedy.
Representative Hines, quickly, how are things going at the legislature? Is there a new tone, and what will be the order of business this week in Phoenix?
That is a great question, and I have to say, you know, there's still some partisanship, of course, but the very first bill that we were able to pass was actually this Funeral Protection Act to prevent any kind of protesters from disrupting a grieving family and friends for any individuals at high-profile funerals, at any funerals. And it was a bipartisan piece of legislation. I personally circulated that bill to the throughout members of the House. Everybody signed on to it, and it passed the floor unanimously and was signed into law immediately by the governor last week.
Is there any kind of feel of bipartisanship moving forward, do you think?
I believe so. I've sponsored some legislation, and some of my members of the Democratic Caucus have also sponsored legislation with multiple Republican co-sponsors, and for a recent example, last week on Thursday, legislation officially outlawing Spice or K2, that synthetic type of marijuana that is actually quite dangerous. I brought that bill to the attention of a Republican representative, Amanda Reeve, from Maricopa, and that actually successfully has already passed unanimously the Judiciary Committee in the House. So there really is a hope on many issues that are not contentious, on law enforcement, on public health issues. I think we're going to find a lot of cooperation.
Speaking with State Representative Matt Hines, Representative Hines is the Democratic Minority Whip for the Democrats in the House of Representatives. Quickly, the election of Andre Cherney, who we will hope to be speaking with tomorrow on the Buckmaster Show, your reaction as the state chair, Mr. Cherney.
Sure. You know, Andre is a great guy, and I look forward to working with him. I think that he'll be able to move the party forward in a good direction. And I'm pleased to hear that he was elected by the state PCs, and I think that it's an excellent choice for Arizona.
Representative Hines, thank you very much. And one more quick question on the guns on campus. You see that bill still moving forward? We're just about out of time. Quick answer.
You know, I do see it still moving forward. I really think the sponsor needs to withdraw from consideration that, particularly in light of the recent tragedy in our community.
Okay, Matt Hines, thank you very much for being with us. Have a great week up in Phoenix.
You too. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. It's 9:30 on the Buckmaster Show. We have CNN, a news break on the latest news out of Moscow. The airport bombing. We'll be back at about 34 minutes to the hour talking climate change.
Tucson's Jolt.
Tucson's Jolt.
KJLL, South Tucson.
CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Breaking news, a terrorist bombing at Moscow's busiest airport has killed at least 31 people. Another 130 have been injured. CNN's Matthew Chance in Moscow says police are worried about more attacks.
There's obviously concern that this explosion at Domodedovo Airport, the main airport in the Russian capital, could be just one of a series of explosions that could well take place. That's certainly a concern of the authorities, and they've placed their police forces on high alert.
Two police officers are dead after a shooting in St. Petersburg, Florida today. They were shot while trying to serve an arrest warrant. A deputy U.S. Marshal was injured. Detroit police arrested a guy they think raped at least six women. The suspect was identified through scientific evidence. President Obama will talk about winning the future for America during his State of the Union speech tomorrow. The White House says the president will lay out his plan to make government leaner. the most trusted name in news. This is CNN Radio.
Hey, Kelly. So, who'd you hire to do your emails?
What? You know it's just me here.
Come on, I got your newsletter. Pretty fancy, photos, coupons. Come on, who is it?
Oh, no one, silly. I use Constant Contact.
Really?
With ConstantContact.com, it's so easy. They make me look like $1 million, and the emails really work.
Oh, yeah?
It got you in here today, didn't it?
Touché.
ConstantContact.com. Plans as low as $15 a month with a free 60-day trial.
Want to lower the cost of doing business?
Keep your data safe and easily accessible.
Barracuda Networks can help. The Barracuda Backup Service is the only data storage solution that combines on-site hardware for rapid restores and cloud-based storage for disaster recovery. At just 50 cents per gigabyte per month and advanced deduplication technology to significantly reduce storage space requirements, the Barracuda Backup Service is the most affordable and efficient data storage solution for any size business. Call 888-ANTI-SPAM for your free evaluation unit. 888-ANTI-SPAM. Or visit Barracuda.com.
Listed on the National Register of Historic Places and founded by Isabella Greenway, Arizona's first congresswoman, the Arizona Inn is still the standard bearer for luxury hospitality in Midtown Tucson, just minutes from the University of Arizona. Founded in 1930, the Arizona Inn continues to win top honors for hospitality and dining. Travel and Leisure magazine names the Arizona Inn one of the top 500 hotels in the world for 2011. And the Arizona Inn is proud of its AAA four diamond status for both the hotel and dining room. Whether it's for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or a private event, you can count on Chef Allison's featured seasonal culinary creations to please. The Arizona Inn, a special oasis of hospitality in Midtown Tucson, 2200 East Elm, and on the web at arizonainn.com.
Hi, I'm Mark Sublett, owner of Medicine Man Gallery, and I'd like to invite you to come visit me. Medicine Man Gallery is located at 7000 East Tinka Verde, at the southwest corner of Tinka Verde and Sabino Canyon, and online at medicinemangallery.com. With 12,000 square feet of exhibit space, we have a wide array of American paintings, antique Indian art, and contemporary modern art by some of the masters of the West, including Ed Nell, John Moyers, and Maynard Dixon. If you have old Indian art or American paintings you'd like to sell or consign, call me for a free evaluation, as we're always looking to add to our collection. If you can't visit us on Tinka Verde, then visit us online. We have over 6,000 objects to view at medicinemangallery.com. So come visit me, Mark Sublett, at Medicine Man Gallery, on the corner of Tinka Verde and Sabino Canyon, where there's always something new to see.
Thirty-four minutes past the hour on The Buckmaster Show, and I am Bill Buckmaster. The Tucson Valley in southern Arizona, currently in a drought, been that way for actually more than a decade. The current dry spell is being blamed on La Nina. Joining us in studio, Zach Guido, Associate Physical Scientist for the Climate Assessment for the Southwest, which is based at the University of Arizona Institute for the Environment. Also with us on the Buckmaster Show live line, Mitch Tobin. He is the Buckmaster Show contributor on the environment. Mr. Tobin is a former environmental reporter for the Arizona Daily Star and the Tucson Citizen. He's the author of Endangered, which shows how so many species are at risk of extinction. Mitch Tobin resides up in Colorado, and he'll be with us shortly. But before we bring Mitch in, I want to welcome Mr. Guido. Zach, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me about this La Nina event that we are currently in. And when people hear La Nina, they get confused with El Nino. Can you put it in terms that we can all understand?
Sure. Well, I'll try. The La Nina events, they start in the tropical Pacific Ocean between Peru and Indonesia, and it's basically a cooling of the sea surface temperatures below average. And when those, and the El Nino events are the converse, it's a warming of the sea surface temperatures above average. And both of those events impact our weather here in the Southwest by shifting the position of the air currents that bring in storms in the Pacific Ocean into this region. So in El Nino events, the position of the jet stream is more in line with the southwest, and we get more rain, more storms come into the area. But during La Nina events, which we're currently in, it's the opposite, in that that airflow is more to the north, and storms are less frequent in the area. They frequent more the Pacific Northwest. And by and large, if you look at the statistics, we're drier than average during La Nina events, which is what we're seeing this winter.
Mitch Tobin is with us also. Mitch, you want to jump in here and ask a question about climate change and the La Nina event that we're in?
Well, it's been an interesting La Nina. I live in Colorado, and we've had a sort of dual story here. In Denver, it's been very, very dry. But up in the mountains, it's been wetter than normal. And it seems like it's actually been a La Nina that hasn't quite followed the script. And I'm wondering what the predictions are for the next couple of months.
In the southern regions of Arizona and New Mexico to be drier than average. High probabilities.
I had hit the wrong switch. Shame on me. So I will re-ask the question. And so some of the listeners didn't hear that. They were Mitch was asking what the prediction is, if you would just repeat that for upcoming months.
The precipitation predictions are for the next few months are for drier than average conditions here in the southwest, particularly in southern portions of Arizona and New Mexico, where the La Nina signal is the strongest.
And why is this the strongest? I think you said this is the strongest in maybe 50, 60 years, this La Nina?
Yeah, it's currently classified as a moderate to strong event, and it is indeed one of the strongest, if not the strongest, in the last 60 years.
Go ahead, Mitch, with another question.
Sure. Just to jump in here with another observation is that it's important for people in Arizona to remember that their water supply is very much dependent on the Colorado River Basin, which extends all the way up into Wyoming and here in Colorado. And there's been some recent news that there's projections that the Colorado River is going to get a little more water than normal. And so I was wondering if you're hearing anything in terms of the impact on the Colorado River and the reservoirs that are so important to Arizonans.
Right. Some of the it is true that the Colorado and parts of Utah and Wyoming are in fact seeing above average snowpack currently. It's a little early to make predictions about stream flow, but certainly with 70 to 80% of the water in the Colorado River coming from the snowpacks in those regions, it bodes well. Now the El Nino and the La Nina signal isn't as strong in those regions in Colorado and Utah and Wyoming as it is in southern Arizona. So while we're dry here, the water supply and the snows oftentimes are average or above average up there.
Let me ask you about the monsoon. When you have a La Nina event like we're having in the winter, Zach, what does that usually mean for a summer thunderstorm moisture?
Well, this isn't my field, so but what I understand is the La Nina and El Nino events tend to be strongest felt in the winter because that's when the sea surface temperatures peak. And so the La Nina and El Nino effect isn't as strong on the summer monsoon. There's other climate variability, modes of climate variability that's going on that influences the monsoon more than El Nino and La Nina do.
Could we be in a drought? We had, as you know, Tom Swetnam was on the program from the Tree Ring Laboratory last week, and he was saying there are historically droughts here in southern Arizona that could last 50 or 60 years. Is there any way to gauge whether we're in a very long-term event or just a long event?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I mean, certainly when you look at the past records pieced together by tree rings, there's been mega droughts, droughts that have lasted on the order of 50, 60 years where precipitation and stream flow, how it's measured, has been below average than what we've seen so far. Now, there's a lot of things that influence the climate on sort of decadal or 10-year plus timescales, such as different oscillations in addition to El Nino and La Nina, things in the North Pacific and North Atlantic. And all of these natural climate variabilities at times align up so that it's enhanced dryness in the region for longer periods of time. It's a little bit difficult to, in my understanding, to piece that all together to look forward, particularly because, you know, of the prospect of climate change sort of influencing all those different natural climate variabilities in different ways. And so it's a target for research right now, and it's one of the grails, so to speak.
University of Arizona climate scientist Zach Guido is with me in studio. Mitch Tobin is on the phone from Colorado. Mitch is our Buckmaster Show contributor on the environment. Mitch, go ahead with a question for Zach.
Thanks, Bill. Zach, I was wondering if you do have any sense of what the wildfire season is going to hold in store for the Southwest, or if it's too early to tell at this point.
No, I think if the dryness continues here in the Southwest, and I'm going to contain my discussion to the Southwest here, because that's really what I've looked at recently. Mm-hmm. But if the weather continues to be dry, then the prospect of an active fire season is enhanced, particularly after average or wetter than average monsoon seasons. So I think, you know, it's been dry so far here in southern Arizona, particularly in southern Arizona and most of New Mexico. And I think if that continues, then there probably will be an active fire season, or at least the chances for an active fire season are greater.
Zach, you are part of what you do at the University of Arizona as part of something called the Institute for the Environment. Quickly tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's the Institute of the Environment. And,
of the Environment, sorry.
And it's a campus-wide effort that it's a campus-wide effort that brings together researchers that are involved in environmental issues. And so it's about creating opportunities and collaboration on issues surrounding the environment. And those span the gamut from public health to climate science to planning.
I'm sure you hear this all the time. Some people don't buy into climate change. What do you say to those people? Hey, it's when someone says, this isn't for real, it's all natural part of the Earth cycle or whatever. What do you say?
Well, from my perspective, it's hard not to see that some of our actions are, in fact, causing human climate change. And it is true that there's natural climate fluctuations that go on that sort of muddle the signal a little bit. But if you look at the data, particularly temperature, and you look at some of the actions that humans have been doing since the Industrial Revolution, there seems to be a clear link between increasing fossil fuel use, increasing greenhouse gas emissions, and increasing temperatures. And also, when you look at the subtleties in the environment, you can see changes. The environment's moving around, and it's often difficult for people to sense, you know, a 2-degree temperature rise. But it's not that difficult for certain animals or plants to experience that.
Less than a minute to go. Mitch Tobin, a quick final question from Colorado for Zach Guido.
Well, Zach, maybe you could explain how climate change might interact with El Nino and La Nina. I mean, those are patterns that affect the weather on a yearly type basis, whereas climate change is a much longer term phenomenon. And I'm wondering how the two of those might interact in the future.
Well, that's a great question, and
for a 30-second response,
yeah, that's going to be tough. That answer has yet to be found. There's a couple different thoughts on it. One is that in a warming world, the tropical Pacific sea surface temperatures will warm, and you'll get more of an El Nino response state. A natural background state will be El Nino. Conversely, Some theories out there pose the La Nina thermostat, which is if the environment warms up too much, then the oceans kick into a La Nina event, and so there might be more in the future La Nina events. So I think that remains to be seen.
Good questions. Mitch Tobin from Colorado joining us this morning on the Buckmaster Show. Mitch, you have a terrific day.
Thanks very much, Bill. Take care.
Thank you very much. And Zach Guido, a U of A climate scientist who's been with us live in studio. Zach, thanks for sharing some of your thoughts.
Thanks. Great.
All right. We will be back on the Buckmaster Show. It's 46 minutes past the hour.
The Arizona Inn is the only Tucson hotel named by Travel and Leisure magazine as one of the top 500 hotels in the world for 2011. Located in Midtown, close to the University of Arizona, the Arizona Inn is located at 2200 East Elm Street and on the web at arizonainn.com. The Arizona Inn maintains AAA four diamond status for both the hotel and dining room, with Chef Allison serving up breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily, with a featured menu and seasonal favorites. And because the Arizona Inn is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, founded by Arizona's first Congresswoman, Isabella Greenway, the Arizona Inn provides an historic backdrop for your next special event. Arizona Inn is the perfect setting for weddings, anniversary celebrations, or your next business meeting. And you can make your reservations online at arizonainn.com. The Arizona Inn, luxury and elegance in the heart of Tucson.
Sarnoff Artist Materials is your one-stop store for fine and graphic artist supplies, framing, stationery, and Mont Blanc and other top-of-the-line writing instruments. Order online at sarnoffart.com or visit owner-operator Henry Sarnoff and his store staffed by artists, for artists, and those who seek the finest quality in everything art-related. Sarnoff Artist Materials, 2504 North Campbell, three blocks north of Grant, and always at sarnoffart.com.
Taste pizza as it was meant to be at Vero More, Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan pizza, topped with the finest, freshest quality ingredients. Enjoy casual yet upscale dining while sampling our extensive boutique wine list. Vero More in Tucson at North Swan and Camp Lowell, Dove Mountain in Marana, and on the web at ferroamorepizza.com. And coming soon, Noble Hops, Tucson's first gastro pub.
Coming up now on 49 minutes past the hour on the Buckmaster Show. I am Bill Buckmaster. We're live 9 to 10 a.m. on KJLL and, of course, anytime on buckmastershow.com. Well, tomorrow evening, Pima Community College kicks off its 2011 speakers series. All the sessions are free of charge and be held at 6 p.m. in the community boardroom of the PCC District Office. That's at 4905 East Broadway Boulevard. The leadoff presentation will be delivered by Dr. David Steffen, who is in studio with me now on the Buckmaster Show. Dr. Steffen is an anthropology archaeology faculty member and director of the Archaeology Center at the Pima Community College West Campus. Dr. Steffen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Well, the topic tomorrow for your presentation will be, does the past have a future? And I find that very intriguing topic. A little bit about what some of your thoughts are there.
Well, I think one of the conceptions that the public can have when they think about the past is they think about the past a long time ago. We think of sites that archaeological sites that go back thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, even push back now over 2 million years. But when you're looking at dealing with cultural resources, which is the general term for archaeological sites, that threshold is 50 years ago. When materials are 50 years old or greater, they must be assessed archaeologically and historically as to their potential importance. So we have the deep past, and then we really have the emerging past, which is looking at historical period materials.
Which fascinates you the most?
I have a long time motto that the deader, the better.
The deader, the better.
Right. I prefer to work with things that are deep in antiquity. So my original field work was in Ethiopia, looking for materials that dated back over 2 million years ago. But as an anthropologist and archaeologist, you have to shift with the changing times. And with the, you can look at Tucson, 50 years old, many of the red brick houses will now meet that state standard that if it's 50 years old, you have to look at it.
This community is rather old. I guess this is there's a deep
certainly a deep historic past here, isn't there?
There's a deep historic past in terms of Tucson itself. And then if you look back deeper in time, we have archaeological sites going back to near the end of the last ice age, 10, 11, 12,000 years ago. And I think it was a consequence of the sense of place that people in Tucson have. Tucson has a strong interest in archaeology, both publicly, and as a town, Tucson has a strong focus on archaeology, in large part because of the University of Arizona, the Arizona State Museum. And also as an industry, there's been a strong startup in the private sector of archaeology in Tucson.
Young people being attracted to archaeology, where does one get a degree in archaeology?
Well, in this country, you actually don't get degrees in archaeology.
I mean, that seems like an obvious question,
right.
But there, it's not really what we think it's going to be your answer.
No, when you introduced me, yes. First it was as an anthropologist.
Yes.
Because in North America, your training or your education in archaeology falls under departments of anthropology. And there's typically four subfields in anthropology, one of which is archaeology. So your initial foray into education could be at a community college such as Pima Community College, moving on to a bachelor's degree at a university. And then if you're looking at a career path in archaeology, then you would pursue a master's degree. If you're looking at going into the academy, being at a university, you're probably going to pursue a degree at the PhD level.
You've been overseeing research projects along with your students from Pima Community College and staff members far away places from Hawaii over to near Baghdad you were working. How have the conditions changed in Iraq?
I'm working in Baghdad, Arizona. You have to be careful when you read the word.
Oh, my goodness.
Because the H has dropped out of that.
Oh, big difference.
Big difference,
yes.
So
Baghdad, Arizona, as I recall, that's up near Kingman.
It is up near
Kingman. Isn't that where they have the mules that are running wild?
Right. Well, there's the big copper mine. But Baghdad, Arizona is an extremely remote area in terms of its low location within Arizona. And it's... also one that has been very minimally studied. So we're working with a cooperative agreement with the Bureau of Land Management, and they're actually funding a summer field school where we take our students up and work in this area.
The travel time is a lot less to Baghdad, Arizona, than Baghdad, Iraq. Sorry about that. And your lecture tomorrow, I want to point out that Pima Community College, Dr. Steffen's lecture, will kick off the 2011 speaker series. The public is invited, all sessions free of charge, held at 6 p.m. in the community boardroom of the PCC District Office at 4905 East Broadway Boulevard. I want to ask you about the protections that are afforded our cultural resources, not only here in Arizona, but across the country.
The level of protection is very much dependent upon the ownership of the property. The maximum protections are afforded on public lands, specifically Forest Service, National Park. And there's over 100 years of history of laws protecting federal antiquities located on federal lands. It shifts a bit when you look at the state level. Arizona has an antiquities law that helps preserve archaeological sites on the roughly 9 million acres of state land. As you move off the public lands onto private lands, those laws do not directly apply. So then it gets down to whether or not a community, a municipality, has laws which promote the preservation. Pima County has a very impressive set of laws, regulations with respect to preserving the archaeological and cultural resources of our community.
How is the employment picture turned around, or has it turned around, for all these young people that you're teaching at Pima Community College who want to be perhaps future archaeologists or anthropologists?
The profile has shifted tremendously. If you're looking for a job in archaeology, 85% of the positions in archaeology are in a field called cultural resource management. There have always been public archaeologists who worked for agencies, federal agencies, state agencies, with the shift with the development of the of antiquities legislation or regulations in the late 1960s, there was a much more there was a big push with respect to being able to respond to these laws. To do so, the archaeologists moved out of the academy into private firms. So what we're seeing now is the majority of the work that's being done in archaeology is done in the private sector at these cultural resource management firms. So looking for jobs, the job market is flat or shrinking in academia, and it's expanding and seems to continue to be expanding in the private sector.
What attracts the young people? What are you hearing why they're going into this field? What is it about your particular business that attracts young people?
Well, I think in our culture of the past, the past is a story. Everybody likes stories. Archaeology combines stories with an element of science, and I think that combination of interest in the past and attempting to preserve some of the heritage in large part is what draws people. Archaeology still maintains an aura of excitement to it, and this is what brings people to it initially.
How much field work do you typically do a year?
It depends a lot on the year. Pima College has the largest field program for a community college in the United States. We rival many four-year schools in terms of the amount of work that we do. Most field schools are taught during the summers through universities. We structure our field school in part because of our environment to go through the fall and the spring semester. So we have a 9-month program. We're in the field at least one, maybe 2 days a week. Then during the summers, we try to go to areas that expose our students to different cultures and different types of archaeology, hence the project in Baghdad and some of the work we've been doing overseas.
I mentioned also there was a project going on in Hawaii. That sounds like a fun project.
Yeah, my PhD was actually in Oceania. I was working on Guam, so shifting to Hawaii is not really that odd when you think about it. We were interested in doing some mapping on the Big Island of Hawaii on some of the large architecturally based sites there. So we do a lot of work in high-tech archaeology, GPS systems, and computerized mapping. So we went over there and worked in combination with some people from the University of Hawaii and their field school and helped map some of these sites.
We've got about a minute left, Dr. Steffen. What would you like folks to perhaps take away from your message tomorrow night at the speaker series?
Well, I think the one big message is that the past probably isn't what they think that it is, and that in order for the past to be preserved, there needs to be active involvement, not only by professionals within archaeology, but by members of the local community, and that people interested in jobs in archaeology are not limited to academia.
Dr. Steffen, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. We're going to have to run. This is the Buckmaster Show at buckmastershow.com and on KJLL. Have a great day. See you tomorrow.
Got something on your mind?
The time has come for all of us to speak out.
Call in and let us know.
Now start talking.
Talk about how you feel.
KJLL, South Tucson.